On the wet white alb of the priest, the crossed stripes of his stole shimmered a wondrous purple. The valley lay gilded and sparkling with moisture, as if at the bottom of a dark blue grotto, for the storm clouds had gathered around the mountain ridges and, brought low by the rays of the sun, had turned the heights black. The haze fled between the peaks, and the great crest above Formo reached up from the darkness, dazzling white with new snow. She had seen Nokfa walk past. The drenched garments clung to the boys as they sang at the top of their lungs to the sunshine. Salvator mundi, salva nos omnes. Kyrie eleison, Christe eleison, Christe audi nos. The priests with the cross had gone past. The group of farmers followed in their heavy, soaked clothing, but looking around them at the weather with amazed and shining faces as they took up the prayer's refrain, Kyrie eleison. Suddenly she saw. She couldn't believe her own eyes. And now it was her turn to grab hold of the woman next to her for support. There was Erland walking along in the procession. He was wearing a dripping wet coat made of reindeer hide, with the hood pulled over his head. But it was him. His lips were slightly parted, and he was crying. Kyrie eleison, along with the others. He looked right at her as he walked past. She couldn't properly decipher the expression on his face, but it looked as if he wore a shadow of a smile. Together with the other women, she joined the procession as it moved up the church hill, calling out with the others as the young boy sang the litany. She was unaware of anything except the wild pounding of her own heart. During the mass, she caught a glimpse of him only once. She didn't dare stand in her customary place, but hid in the darkness of the north nave. As soon as the service was over, she rushed outdoors. She fled from her maids who had been in church. Outside, the countryside was steaming in the sunshine. Kristen raced home without noticing the sodden state of the road. She spread a cloth over the table and set a full horn of mead before the master's high seat, before she took time to exchange her wet clothes for her Sabbath finery, the dark blue embroidered gown, silver belt, buckled shoes, and the wimple with the blue border. Then she knelt in the alcove. She couldn't think, she couldn't find the words she sought. Over and over again she said the Ave Maria. Blessed Lady, dear Lord, Son of the Virgin, you know what I want to say. This went on for a long time. From her maids she heard that the men had gone back to the bridge. With broad axes and hooks they were trying to remove the tangle of debris that had gotten caught. It was a matter of saving the bridge. The priests had also gone back after they had taken off their vestments. It was well past midday when the men returned. Kristen's sons, Ulf Haldorsson, and the three servants. An old man and two youths who had been given refuge on the manor. Nokfa had already sat down at his place, to the right of the high seat. Suddenly he stood up, stepped forward, and rushed for the door. Kristen softly called out his name. A moment later he came back and sat down. The color came and went in his young face. He kept his eyes lowered, and now and then he had to bite his lip. His mother saw that he was struggling hard to master his feelings, but he managed to do so. Finally, the meal came to an end. Her sons, who were seated on the inner bench, rose to their feet and came around the end of the table past the vacant high seat, adjusting their belts as they usually did after they had put their knives back in their sheaths. Then they left the room. When they had all gone, Kristen followed. In the sunshine, water was now streaming off all the eaves. There wasn't a soul in the courtyard except for Ulf. He was standing on the doorstep to his own house. His face took on an oddly helpless expression when the mistress approached him. He didn't speak, and so she asked quietly, "Did you talk to him?" "Only a few words. I saw that he and Nokfa talked." After a moment he went on. "He was a little worried about all of you when the flooding got this bad, so he decided to head home to see how things were. Nokfa told him how you were handling everything. I don't know how he happened to hear about it, that you gave away the pelts he sent with Gauta in the fall. He was cross about that. Also, when he heard that you had rushed home right after the mass, he thought you would have stayed to talk to him. Kristen didn't say a word. She turned on her heel and went back inside. That summer, there were constant quarrels and strife between Ulf Haldorsson and his wife. The son of Ulf's half-brother, Haldor Jonsson, had come to visit his kinsmen in the spring, along with his wife. He had been married the year before. It was understood that Haldor would now lease the estate Ulf owned in Skaun and move there on turnover day. But Jartrud was angry because she thought Ulf had given his nephew conditions that were too good, and she saw that it was the men's intention to ensure for Haldor, perhaps through some kind of agreement, inheritance of the estate after his uncle's death. Haldor had been Kristen's personal servant at Husaby, and she was very fond of the young man. She also liked his wife, who was a quiet and proper young woman. Shortly after midsummer, the couple had a son, and Kristen lent the wife her weaving house, where the mistresses of the estate used to reside whenever they gave birth. But Jartrud took offense that Kristen herself should attend the woman as the foremost of the midwives, even though Jartrud was young and quite inexperienced, unable to offer help with a birth or with caring for a newborn infant. Kristen was the boy's godmother, and Ulf gave the christening banquet. But Jartrud thought he lavished too much on it, and put too many costly gifts in the cradle and in the mother's bed. To placate his wife somewhat, Ulf gave her several precious items from among his own possessions: a gilded cross on a chain, a fur-lined cape with a large silver clasp, a gold ring, and a silver brooch. But she saw that he refused to present her with a single parcel of land that he owned, aside from what he had given her when they married. Everything else would go to his half-siblings if he himself had no offspring. Now Jartrud lamented that her child had been stillborn, and it seemed unlikely that she would have any more. She was ridiculed throughout the countryside because she talked about this to everyone. Ulf had to ask Kristen to allow Haldor and Aldild to live in the hearth house after the young wife had gone to church for the first time after giving birth. Kristen gladly consented. She avoided Haldor because she was reminded of so many things that were painful to think about whenever she spoke with her former servant. But she talked a great deal with his wife, for Audhild wanted to help Kristen as much as she could. Toward the end of the summer, the child fell gravely ill, and then Kristen stepped in to tend the boy for his young and inexperienced mother. When the couple journeyed north in the fall, she missed them both, but she missed the child even more. She realized it was foolish, but in recent years she couldn't help feeling some measure of pain because she suddenly seemed to be barren. And yet she wasn't an old woman, not even 40. It had helped to keep her thoughts off painful matters when she had the childish young wife and her infant to care for and advise. And even though she found it sad to see that Ulf Haldorsson had not found greater happiness in his marriage, the state of affairs in the foreman's house had also served to divert her thoughts from other things. After the way Erland had behaved on Ascension Day, she hardly dared to speculate any more about how the whole situation might end. The fact that he had appeared in the village and the church in full view of everyone, and then had raced northward again without speaking a single word of greeting to his wife, seemed to her so heartless that she felt as if she had at last grown completely indifferent toward him. She had not exchanged a word with Simon Andersson since the day of the spring floods when he came to help her. She would greet him and often speak a few words to her sister at church. But she had no idea what they thought about her affairs or the fact that Erland had gone away to Dovre. On the Sunday before St. Bartholomew's Day, Sir Geird of Diefrin came to church with the people from Formo. Simon looked immensely happy as he went inside for Mass at his brother's side, and Romborg came over to Kristen after the service, eagerly whispering that she was with child again and expected to give birth around the feast of the Virgin Mary in the spring.
"Kristen's sister, can't you come home and celebrate with us today?"
Kristen shook her head sadly, patted the young woman's pale cheek, and prayed that God might bring the parents joy, but she said that she couldn't go to Formo. After the falling out with his brother-in-law, Simon tried to make himself believe that it was for the best. His position was such that he didn't need to ask how people might judge his actions and everything. He had helped Erlund and Kristen when it mattered, and the assistance he could offer them here in the parish was not so important that he should allow it to make his own life more complicated. But when he heard that Erlund had left Jorngard, it was impossible for Simon to sustain the stubborn, melancholy calm he had striven to display. It was useless to tell himself that no one fully understood what lay behind Erlund's absence. People chattered so much, but knew so little. Even so, he couldn't get himself mixed up in this matter. But he was still uneasy. At times he wondered whether he ought to seek out Erlund at Haugen and take back the words he had said when they parted. Then he could see about finding some way to return order to the affairs of his brother-in-law and his wife's sister. But Simon never got any farther than thinking about this. He didn't think anyone could tell from looking at him that his heart was uneasy. He lived as he always had, running his farm and managing his properties. He went up to the mountains to hunt when he had time and spoiled his children when he was home. And never was an unkind word spoken between him and his wife. For the servants of the manor, it must have looked as if the friendship between Romborg and him was now better than it had ever been, since his wife was more even-tempered and calm, never exhibiting those fits of capriciousness and childish anger over petty matters. But secretly, Simon felt awkward and uncertain in his wife's company. He could no longer make himself treat her as if she were still half a child, teasing and pampering her. He didn't know how he should treat her anymore. Neither did he know how to take it when she told him one evening that she was again with child. "I suppose you're not particularly happy about it, are you?" he finally said, stroking her hand.
"But surely you are happy, aren't you?"
Romborg pressed close to him, half crying and half laughing. He laughed, a little embarrassed, as he pulled her into his arms.
"I'll be sensible this time, Simon. I won't behave the way I did before. But you must stay with me, do you hear me? Even if all your brothers-in-law and all your brothers were to be led off to the gallows, one after the other, with their hands bound, you mustn't leave me."
Simon laughed sadly. "Where would I go, my Romborg? Germund, that poor creature, isn't likely to get mixed up in any weighty matters, and he's the only one left among my friends and kinsmen that I haven't quarreled with yet."
"Oh."
Romborg laughed too as her tears fell.
"That enmity will last only until they need a helping hand, and you think you can offer it. I know you too well by now, my husband."
2 weeks later, Geert Andresen unexpectedly arrived at the manor. The Diefrin knight had brought only a single man as an escort. The meeting between the brothers took place with few words spoken. Sir Geert explained that he hadn't seen his sister and brother-in-law at Kruka in all these years, and so he had decided to come north to visit them. Since he was in the valley, Sigrid felt he should also visit Formo. "And I thought, brother, that surely you couldn't be so angry with me that you wouldn't offer me and my servant food and lodging until tomorrow." "You know I will," said Simon as he stood looking down, his face dark red. "It was noble of you, Geert, to come to see me." The brothers walked through the fields after they had eaten. The grain was starting to turn pale on the slopes facing the sun down by the river. The weather was so beautiful. The log now glittered gently enough, visible as little white flashes amid the alder trees. Big glossy clouds drifted across the summer sky. Sunshine filled the entire basin of the valley, and the mountain on the other side looked light blue and green in the shimmer of heat and the fleeting shadows of the clouds. A pounding sound came from the pasture behind them as the horses trampled across the dry hillside. The herd came rushing through the alder thickets. Simon leaned over the fence. "Foal, foal. Bronstein's getting old, isn't he?" he said as Geard's horse poked his head over the rail and nudged his shoulder. 18 winters, Geard stroked the horse. I thought, kinsman, that this matter... It wouldn't be right if it should end the friendship between you and me, he said without looking at his brother. It has grieved me every single day, replied Simon softly. Thank you for coming, Geard. They continued walking along the fence, Geard first, with Simon plodding behind. Finally, they sank down on the edge of a little yellow-scorched stony embankment. A strong, sweet fragrance came from the small mounds of hay that were scattered about, where the scythe had scraped together short stalks of hay mixed with flowers between the piles of stones. Geard spoke of the reconciliation between King Magnus and the Hoftersons and their followers. After a moment, Simon asked, Do you think it's out of the question that any of these kinsmen of Erland Nikolausen would be willing to attempt to win full reconciliation for him and clemency from the king? There is not much I can do, said Geird Dara. And they have few kind words to say of him, Simon, those who might be able to do something. Oh, I have little desire to talk of this matter now. I thought he was a bold and splendid fellow, but the others think he brought his plans to such a bad end. But I'd rather not talk of this now. I know you're so fond of that brother-in-law of yours. Simon sat gazing out across the silvery white brilliance of the crowns of the trees on the hillside and the sparkling gleam of the river. Surprised, he thought that yes, in a way it was true, what Geard had said. Except that right now we are foes, Erland and I, he said. It's been a long time since we last spoke. It seems to me that you've grown quite quarrelsome over the years, Simon, said Geard with a laugh. After a moment, he continued, Haven't you ever thought of moving away from these valleys? We kinsmen could support each other more if we lived closer to each other. How can you even think of such a thing? Formo is my ancestral estate. Osmund of Eiken owns part of the manor through inherited rights, and I know that he would not be unwilling to exchange one ancestral property for another. He hasn't yet given up the idea that if he could win your Arnyard for his Grunda on the terms that he mentioned. Simon shook his head. The lineage of our father's mother has resided on this estate ever since Norway was a heathen land. And it is here that I intend for Andres to live when I'm gone. I don't think you have your wits about you, brother. How could I give up Formo? No, that's understandable. Geard blushed a little. I merely thought that perhaps... Most of your kinsmen are at Raumarike, along with the friends from your youth. Perhaps you might find that you'd thrive better there. I'm thriving here. Simon had also turned red. This is the place where I can give the boy a secure seat. He looked at Geard, and his brother's fine, furrowed face took on an embarrassed expression. Geard's hair was now almost white, but his body was still just as slender and lithe as ever. He shifted rather uneasily. Several stones rolled out from the pile of rocks and tumbled down the slope and into the grain. Are you going to send the whole scree down into my field? Asked Simon in a stern voice as he laughed. Geard leaped to his feet, light and agile, reaching out a hand to his brother, who moved more slowly. Simon gripped his brother's hand for a moment after he got to his feet. Then he placed his arm around his brother's shoulder. Geard did the same, and with their arms loosely resting around each other's shoulders, the brothers slowly walked over the hills toward the manor. They sat together in the Simond house that night. Simon would share a bed with his brother. They had said their evening prayers, but they wanted to empty the ale keg before they went to bed. Benedictus tu in mulieribus. Mulieribus. Do you remember that? Simon laughed suddenly. Yes. It cost me a few blows across the back before Sira Magnus wrung our grandmother's misteachings out of my head. Geard smiled at the memory. And he had a devilishly hard hand, too. Do you remember, brother, that time when he sat and scratched the calves of his legs, and he had lifted up the hem of his robe? You whispered to me that if you had had such misshapen calves as Magnus Kettleson, you would have become a priest, too, and always worn full-length surcoats. Simon smiled. Suddenly, he seemed to see the boyish face of his brother, about to burst with stifled laughter, his eyes pitifully miserable. They weren't very old back then, and Sera Magnus was cruelly hard-handed whenever he had to reprimand them. Geird had not been terribly clever when they were children. And it wasn't because Geird was a particularly wise man that Simon loved him now. But he felt warm with gratitude and tenderness toward his brother as he sat there. For every day of their kinship during almost 40 years, and for Geird, just the way he was, the most loyal and forthright of men. It seemed to Simon that winning back his brother Geird was like gaining a firm foundation for at least 1 foot. And for such a long time his life had been so unreasonably disjointed and complicated. He felt a warmth inside every time he thought about Geird, who had come to him to make amends for something that Simon himself had provoked when he rode to his brother's estate in anger and with curses. His heart overflowed with gratitude. He had to thank more than Geird. A man such as Lavrans. He knew quite well how he would have handled such an event. He could follow his father-in-law as far as he was able, by giving out alms and the like. But he wasn't capable of such things as true contrition or contemplation of the wounds of the Lord, unless he stared zealously at the crucifix. And that was not what Lavrans had intended. Simon couldn't bring forth tears of remorse. He hadn't wept more than 2 or 3 times since he was a child, and never when he needed to most. Those times when he had committed the worst of sins, with Arnyard's mother while he was a married man, and that killing the previous year. And yet he had felt great regret. He thought that he always sincerely regretted his sins, taking pains to confess and to atone as the priest commanded. He was always diligent in saying his prayers and saw to it that he gave the proper tithes and abundant alms, with particular generosity in honor of the Apostle St. Simon, St. Olav, St. Michael, and the Virgin Mary. Otherwise, he was content with what Sera Eirik had said, that salvation was to be found in the cross alone, and how a man faced or fought with the fiend was something for God to decide, and not the man himself. But now he felt an urge to show his gratitude to the Holy Ones with greater fervor. His mother had told him that he was supposedly born on the birthday of the Virgin Mary. He decided that he wanted to show the Lord's Mother his veneration with a prayer he was not usually accustomed to saying. He had once had a beautiful prayer copied out, back when he was at the royal court, and he took out the small piece of parchment. Now, much later, he feared that it was probably intended more as an appeal to King Håkon than for the sake of God or Mary, that he had acquired these small epistles with prayers and learned them while he was among the king's retainers. All the young men did so, for the king was in the habit of quizzing the pages about what they knew of such useful knowledge when he lay in bed at night, unable to sleep. Oh yes, that was so long ago. The king's bedchamber in the stone hall of the Oslo Palace. On the little table next to his bed burned a single candle. The light fell across the finely etched, faded, and aging face of the man, resting above the red silken quilts. When the priest had finished reading aloud and taken his leave, the king often picked up the book himself and lay in bed, reading with the heavy volume resting against his propped-up knees. On 2 footstools over by the brick fireplace sat the pages. Simon nearly always had the watch with Gunstein Ingesson. It was pleasant in the chamber. The fire burned brightly, giving heat without smoke. And the room seemed so snug with the cross-beamed ceiling and the walls always covered with tapestries. But they would grow sleepy from sitting there in that fashion, first listening to the priest read, and then waiting for the king to fall asleep, as he rarely did until close to midnight. When he was sleeping, they were allowed to take turns keeping guard and napping on the bench between the fireplace and the door to the royal council hall. Occasionally the king would converse with them. This didn't happen often, but when it did, he was inexpressibly kind and charming. Or he would read aloud from the book a sentence or a few stanzas of a verse that he thought the young men might find useful or beneficial to hear. One night, Simon was awakened by King Håkon calling for him in pitch darkness. The candle had burned out. Feeling wretched with shame, Simon blew some life into the embers and lit a new candle. The king lay in bed, smiling secretively.
Does that Gunnstein always snore so terribly?
Yes, my lord.
You share a bed with him in the dormitory, don't you?
It might be deemed reasonable if you asked for another bedfellow for a while who makes less noise when he sleeps.
Thank you, my lord, but it doesn't bother me, your majesty.
Surely you must wake up, Simon, when that thunder explodes right next to your ear.
Don't you?
Yes, your grace. But then I give him a shove and turn him over a bit. The king laughed.
I wonder whether you young men realize that being able to sleep so soundly is one of God's great gifts.
When you reach my age, Simon, my friend, perhaps you will remember my words.
That seemed endlessly far away. Still clear, but not as if he were the same man sitting here now who had once been that young page.
One day at the beginning of Advent, when Kristen was almost alone on the estate, her sons were bringing home firewood and moss, she was surprised to see Simon Dara come riding into the courtyard. He had come to invite her and her sons to be their guests during Christmas.
You know quite well, Simon, that we can't do that, she said somberly. We can still be friends in our hearts, you and Romborg and I. But as you know, it's not always possible for us to determine what we must do.
Surely you don't mean that you're going to take this so far that you won't come to your only sister when she has to lie down to give birth.
Kristen prayed that all would go well and bring both of them joy. But I can't tell you with certainty that I will come.
Everyone will think it remarkably strange, admonished Simon. You have a reputation for being the best midwife, and she's your sister. And the two of you are the mistresses of the largest estates in the northern part of the region.
Quite a few children have been brought into the world on the great manors around here over the past few years, but I've never been asked to come.
It's no longer the custom, Simon, for a birth to be considered improperly attended if the mistress of Urengard is not in the room. She saw that he was greatly distressed by her words, and so she continued,
Give my greetings to Romborg. And tell her that I will come to help her when it's time. But I cannot come to your Christmas feast, Simon.
But on the eighth day of the Christmas season, she met Simon as he came to Mass without Romborg. No, she was feeling fine, he said, but she needed to rest and gather her strength, for the next day he was taking her and the children south to Diefrin. The weather was so good for traveling by sleigh, and since Geird had invited them, and Romborg was so keen on going, well. Chapter 4 On the day after St. Paul's Day, Simon Dara rode north across Lake Mjøsa, accompanied by two men. A bitter frost had set in, but he didn't think he could stay away from home any longer. The sleighs would have to follow later, as soon as the cold had let up a bit. At Hamar he met a friend, Vigleik Paulsen of Fagerberg, and they continued on together. When they reached Lillehammer, they rested for a while at a farm where ale was served. As they sat and drank, several drunken fur peddlers began brawling in the room. Finally Simon stood up, stepped into the thick of things and separated them. But in doing so, he received a knife wound in his right forearm. It was little more than a scratch, so he paid it no mind, although the proprietress of the alehouse insisted on being allowed to bind a cloth around it. He rode home with Vigleik and stayed the night at his manor. The men shared a bed, and toward morning Simon was awakened because the other man was thrashing in his sleep. Several times Vigleik called out his name, and so Simon woke him up to ask what was wrong. Vigleik couldn't remember his dream properly.
But it was loathsome. And you were in it. One thing I do remember. Simon Ryderson stood in this room and asked you to leave with him. I saw him so clearly that I could have counted every single freckle on his face.
I wish you could sell me that dream, said Simon, half in jest and half seriously.
Simon Ryderson was his uncle's son, and they had been good friends when they were growing up. But the other Simon had died at the age of 13. In the morning when the men sat down to eat, Vigleik noticed that Simon hadn't buttoned the sleeve of his tunic around his right wrist. The flesh was red and swollen all the way down to the back of his hand. He mentioned it, but Simon merely laughed. A little later, when his friend begged him to stay on a few more days and to wait there for his wife, Vigleik couldn't forget his dream. Simon Andresen replied almost indignantly, "Surely you haven't had such a bad dream about me that I should keep to my bed because of a mere louse bite." Around sunset, Simon and his men rode down to Lake Losna. It had been the most beautiful day. Now the towering blue and white peaks turned gold and crimson in the twilight, while along the river the groves, heavy with rime, stood furry gray in the shadows. The men had excellent horses and a brisk ride ahead of them across the long lake. Tiny bits of ice sprayed up, ringing and clinking beneath the hooves of the horses. A biting wind blew hard against them. Simon was freezing, but in spite of the cold, strange, nauseating waves of heat kept washing over him, followed by icy spells that seemed to seep all the way into the marrow of his spine. Now and then he noticed that his tongue was swollen and felt oddly thick at the back of his throat. Even before they had crossed the lake, he had to stop and ask one of his men to help him fasten his cape so it would support his right arm. The servants had heard Vigleik Paulsen recounting his dream. Now they wanted their master to show them his wound. But Simon said it was nothing. It merely stung a bit. "I may have to get used to being left-handed for a few days." But later that night, when the moon had risen and they were riding high along the ridge north of the lake, Simon realized that his arm might turn out to be rather troublesome after all. It ached all the way up to his armpit. The jolting of the horse caused him great pain, and the blood was hammering in his wounded limb. His head was pounding too, and spasms were shooting up from the back of his neck. He was hot and then cold by turn. The winter road passed high up along the slope, partway through forest and partway across white fields. Simon gazed at everything. The full moon was sailing brightly in the pale blue sky, having driven all the stars far away. Only a few larger ones still dared wander in the distant heavens. The white fields glittered and sparkled. The shadows fell short and jagged across the snow. Inside the woods, the uncertain light lay in splotches and stripes among the firs, heavy with snow. Simon saw all this. But at the same time, he saw quite clearly a meadow with tufts of ash-brown grass in the sunlight of early spring. Several small spruce trees had sprung up here and there at the edge of the field. They glowed green like velvet in the sun. He recognized this place. It was the pasture near his home at Diefrin. The alder woods stood beyond the field with its tree trunks a springtime shiny gray and the tops brown with blossoms. Behind stretched the long, low Raumarika ridges, shimmering blue but still speckled white with snow. They were walking down toward the alder thicket, he and Simon Ryderson, carrying fishing gear and pike spears. They were on their way to the lake, which lay dark gray with patches of thawing ice, to fish at the open end. His dead cousin walked at his side. He saw his playmate's curly hair sticking out from his cap, reddish in the spring sunlight. He could see every freckle on the boy's face. The other Simon stuck out his lower lip and blew, phew, phew, whenever he thought his namesake was speaking gibberish. They jumped over meandering rivulets and leaped from mound to mound across the trickling snow water in the grassy meadow. The bottom was covered with moss. Under the water it churned and frothed a lively green. He was fully aware of everything around him. The whole time he saw the road passing up one hill and down another, through the woods and over white fields in the glittering moonlight. He saw the slumbering clusters of houses beneath snow-laden roofs, casting shadows across the fields. He saw the band of fog hovering over the river in the bottom of the valley. He knew that it was Jan who was riding right behind him,
and who moved up alongside him whenever they entered open clearings. And yet he happened to call the man Simon several times. He knew it was wrong, but he couldn't help himself, even though he noticed that his servants grew alarmed. "We must manage to reach the monks at Roaldstad tonight, men," he said once when his mind had cleared. The men tried to dissuade him. Instead, they should see about finding lodgings as soon as possible, and they mentioned the nearest parsonage. But their master clung to his plan. "It will be hard on the horses, Simon." The two men exchanged a glance. But Simon merely laughed. They would have to manage it for once. He thought about the arduous miles. Pain shot through his whole body as he jolted in the saddle. But he wanted to go home, because now he knew that he was fated to die. Even though his heart was alternately freezing and burning in the winter night, at the same time he felt the mild spring sunshine of the pasture back home, while he and the dead boy kept walking and walking toward the alder thicket. For brief moments the image would vanish, and his head would clear, except that it ached so dreadfully. He asked one of his men to cut open the sleeve on his wounded arm. His face turned white, and the sweat poured down when Jon Dahlk cautiously slid open his vest and shirt from his wrist up to his shoulder. But he managed to support the swollen limb himself with his left hand. After a while, the pain began to ease. Then the men started discussing whether they should see about sending word back south to Diefrin once they reached Roaldstad. But Simon had his objections. He didn't want to worry his wife with such a message when it might be unnecessary. A sleigh ride in this bitter cold would be ill-advised. Perhaps, when they were home at Formo, they should wait and see. He tried to smile at Sigurd to cheer up the young servant, who looked quite frightened and distressed. "But you can send word to Kristin at Jorungard as soon as we reach home. She's so skilled at healing." His tongue felt as thick and stiff as wood as he spoke. "Kiss me, Kristin, my betrothed." At first she would think he was speaking in delirium. "No, Kristin." Then she would be surprised. Erland had understood. Romborg had understood. But Kristin? She sat there with her sorrow and rancor, and yet as angry and bitter as she now felt toward that man Erland, she still had no thoughts for anyone else but him. "You've never cherished me enough, Kristin, my beloved, that you might consider how difficult it would be for me when I had to be a brother to the woman who was once meant to be my wife." He hadn't realized it himself back then, when he parted from her outside the convent gate in Oslo, that he would continue to think about her in this way, that he would end up feeling as if nothing he had acquired afterward in life were an equal replacement for what he had lost back then, for the maiden who had been promised to him in his youth. She would hear this before he died. She would give him one kiss. "I am the one who loved you, and who loves you still." He had once heard those words, and he had never been able to forget them. They were from the Virgin Mary's Book of Miracles, a saga about a nun who fled from her convent with a knight. The Virgin saved them in the end and forgave them in spite of their sin. If it was a sin that he said this to his wife's sister before he died, then God's mother would grant him forgiveness for this as well. He had so seldom troubled her by asking for anything. "I didn't believe it myself back then, that I would never feel truly happy or merry again." "No, Simon. It's too great a burden for Sokka if she has to carry both of us, considering how far she has had to travel tonight," he said to the person who had climbed up behind him on the horse and was supporting him. "I can see that it's you, Sigurd. But I thought it was someone else." Toward morning they reached the pilgrim's hostel, and the two monks who were in charge tended to the ill man. After he had revived a little under their care and the feverish days had abated, Simon Andresen insisted on borrowing a sleigh to continue northward. The roads were in good condition. They changed horses along the way, journeyed all night, and arrived at Formo the following morning at dawn.
Simon had lain and dozed under all the covers that someone had spread over him. He felt so weighted down. Sometimes he felt as if he were being crushed under heavy boulders, and his head ached terribly. Now and then he seemed to slip away. Then the pain would begin raging inside him again. It felt as if his body were swelling up more and more, growing unimaginably big and about to burst. There was a constant throbbing in his arm. He tried to walk from the sleigh to the house, with his good arm around Jon's shoulder and Sigurd walking behind to support him. Simon sensed that the faces of the men were gray and grimy with weariness. They had spent 2 nights in a row in the saddle. He wanted to say something to them about it, but his tongue refused to obey him. He stumbled over the threshold and fell full length into the room, with a roar of pain as his swollen and misshapen arm struck against something. The sweat poured off him as he choked back the moans that rose up as he was undressed and helped into bed. Not long afterward, he noticed that Kristin Lavran's daughter was standing next to the fireplace, grinding something with a pestle in a wooden bowl. The sound kept thudding right through his head. She poured something from a small pot into a goblet and added several drops from a glass vial that she took out of a chest. Then she emptied the crushed substance from the bowl into the pot and set it next to the fire. Such a quiet and competent manner she had. She came over to the bed with the goblet in her hand. She walked with such ease. She was just as straight-backed and lovely as she had been as a maiden, this slender woman with the thin, somber face beneath the linen wimple. The back of his neck was also swollen, and it hurt when she slipped one arm under his shoulders to lift him up. She supported his head against her breast as she held the goblet to his lips with her left hand. Simon smiled a little, and as she cautiously let his head slip back down to the pillow, he seized hold of her hand with his good one. Her fine, slim woman's hand was no longer soft or white. "I suppose you can't sew silk with these fingers of yours anymore," said Simon. "But they're good and light. And how pleasantly cool your hand is, Kristin." He placed it on his forehead. Kristin remained standing there until she felt her palm grow warm. Then she removed it and gently pressed her other hand against his burning brow, up along the hairline. "Your arm has a nasty wound, Simon," she said, "but with God's help it will mend." "I'm afraid that you won't be able to heal me, Kristin, no matter how skilled you are with medicines," said Simon. But his expression was almost cheerful. The potion began to take effect. He felt the pain much less. But his eyes felt so strange, as if he had no control over them. He thought he must be lying there with each eye squinting in opposite directions. "No doubt things will go with me as they must," he said in the same tone of voice. Kristin went back to her pots. She spread a paste on some linen cloths, and then came over and wrapped the hot bandages around his arm, from the tips of his fingers all the way around his back and across his chest, where the swelling splayed out in red stripes from his armpit. It hurt at first, but soon the discomfort eased. She spread a woolen blanket on top and placed soft down pillows under his arm. Simon asked her what she had put on the bandages.
"Oh, various things. Mostly comfrey and swallowwort," said Kristin.
"If only it was summer, I could have picked them fresh from my herb garden. But I had a plentiful supply. Thanks be to God, I haven't needed them earlier this winter. What was it you once told me about swallowwort? You heard it from the abbess when you were at the convent. Something about the name.
Do you mean that in all languages it has a name that means swallow? All the way from the Greek sea up to the northern lands?"
"Yes. Because it blossoms everywhere when the swallows awake from their winter slumber." Simon pressed his lips together more firmly. By then, he would have been in the ground for a long time. "I want my resting place to be here, at the church, if I should die, Kristin," he said. "I'm such a rich man by now that someday Andres will most likely possess considerable power here at Formo. I wonder if Romborg will have a son after I'm gone, in the spring. I would have liked to live long enough to see two sons on my estate.
Kristin told him she had sent word south to Diefrin that he was gravely ill, with Gauta, who had ridden off that morning.
You didn't send that child off alone, did you? Asked Simon with alarm.
There was no one at hand whom she thought could manage to keep up with Gauta riding Rauden, she told him. Simon said it would surely be a difficult journey for Romborg, if only she wouldn't travel any faster than she could bear. But I would like to see my children. Some time later he began talking about his children again. He mentioned Arnjord, wondering whether he might have been wrong not to accept the offer from the people of Eiken. But the man seemed too old to him, and he had been afraid that Grunda could turn out to be violent when he was drunk. He had always wanted to place Arnjord in the most secure of circumstances. Now it would be Geird and Gudmund who would decide on her marriage.
Tell my brothers, Kristin, that I sent them my greetings, and that they should tend to this matter with care. If you would take her back to Urengard for a while, I would be most grateful, as I lie in my grave. And if Romborg should remarry before Arnjord's place is assured, then you must take her in, Kristin. You mustn't think that Romborg has been anything but kind toward her. But if she should end up with both a stepmother and a stepfather, I'm afraid she would be regarded more as a servant girl than a... You remember that I was married to Hofred when I became her father.
Kristin gently placed her hand on top of Simon's and promised she would do all she could for the maiden. She remembered everything she had seen of how difficult they were situated, those children who had a nobleman for a father and were conceived in adultery, Orm and Margaret and Ulf Haldorsson. She stroked Simon's hand over and over.
It's not certain that you will die this time, you know, brother-in-law, she said with a little smile.
A glimmer of the sweet and tender smile of a maiden could still pass over her thin, stern woman's face.
You sweet young Kristin.
Simon's fever was not as high that evening, and he said the pain was less. When Kristin changed the bandage on his arm, it was not as swollen, but his skin was darker. And when she cautiously pressed it, the marks from her fingers stayed for a moment. Kristin sent the servants off to bed. She allowed Jon Dahlk, who insisted on keeping watch over his master, to lie down on a bench in the room. She moved the chest with the carved back over next to the bed and sat down, leaning against the corner. Simon dozed and slept. Once, when he woke up, he noticed that she had found a spindle. She was sitting erect, having stuck the distaff with the wool under her left arm, and her fingers were twining the yarn as the spindle dropped lower and lower beside her long, slender lap. Then she rolled up the yarn and began spinning again as the spindle dropped. He fell asleep watching her. When he awoke again, toward morning, she was sitting in the same position, spinning. The light from the candle, which she had placed so the bed hangings would shield him, fell directly on her face. It was so pale and still. Her full, soft lips were narrow and pressed tight. She was sitting with her eyes lowered as she spun. She couldn't see that he was lying awake and staring at her in the shadow of the bed hangings. She looked so full of despair that Simon felt as if his heart were bleeding inside him as he lay there looking at her. She stood up and went over to tend the fire, without a sound. When she came back, she peeked behind the bed hangings and met his open eyes in the dark.
How are you feeling now, Simon? She asked gently.
I feel fine. Now? But he seemed to notice that it felt tender under his left arm, too, and under his chin when he moved his head.
No, it must be just something he imagined.
Oh. She would never think that she had lost anything by rejecting his love. For that matter, he might as well tell her about it. It wasn't possible for that to make her any more melancholy. He wanted to say it to her before he died, at least once. I have loved you all these years. His fever rose again, and his left arm was hurting after all, You must try to sleep some more, Simon. Perhaps you will soon feel better, she said softly.
I've slept a great deal tonight. He began talking about his children again, the three he had and loved so dearly, and the one who was still unborn. Then he fell silent. The pain returned much worse. Lie down for a while, Kristen. Surely Jan can sit with me for a time, if you think it necessary for someone to keep watch. In the morning, when she took off the bandage, Simon replied calmly to her desperate expression. Oh no, Kristen. There was already too much festering and poison in my arm, and I was chilled through before I came into your hands. I told you that I didn't think you could heal me. Don't be so sad about it, Kristen.
You shouldn't have made such a long journey, she said faintly.
No man lives longer than he is meant to live, replied Simon in the same voice. I wanted to come home. There are things we must discuss, how everything is to be arranged after I'm gone. He chuckled. All fires burn out sooner or later.
Kristen gazed at him, her eyes shiny with tears. He had always had so many proverbs on his lips. She looked down at his flushed red face. The heavy cheeks and the folds under his chin seemed to have sunk, lying in deep furrows. His eyes seemed both dull and glistening, but then clarity and intent returned to them. He looked up at her with a steady, searching glance that had been the most constant expression in his small, sharp, steel-gray eyes. When daylight filled the room, Kristen saw that Simon's face had grown pinched around the nose. A white streak stretched downward on either side to the corners of his mouth. She walked over to the little glass-paned window and stood there, swallowing her tears. A golden green light sparkled and gleamed in the thick coating of frost on the window. Outside, it was no doubt as beautiful a day as the whole week had been. It was the mark of death. She knew that. She went back and slid her hand under the coverlet. His ankles were swollen all the way up to his calves.
Do you want me to send for Sarah Eirik now?
She asked in a low voice.
Yes.
Tonight, replied Simon. He had to speak of it before he confessed and received the last rites. Afterward, he must try to turn his thoughts in another direction. It's odd that you should be the one who will probably have to tend to my body, said Simon. And I'm afraid I won't be a particularly handsome corpse.
Kristen forced back a sob. She moved away to prepare another soothing potion. But Simon said, I don't like these potions of yours, Kristen. They make my thoughts so muddled. After a while, he asked her to give him a little all the same. But don't put so much in it that it will make me drowsy. I have to talk to you about something.
He took a sip and then lay waiting for the pain to ease enough that he would have the strength to talk to her clearly and calmly.
Don't you want us to bring Sarah Eirik to you, so he can speak the words that might give you comfort?
Yes, soon. But there is something I must say to you first.
He lay in silence for a while. Then he said, Tell Erland Nikolausen that the words I spoke to him the last time we parted, those words I have regretted every day since. I behaved in a petty and unmanly fashion toward my brother-in-law that night. Give him my greetings and tell him, beg him to forgive me.
Kristen sat with her head bowed. Simon saw that she had turned blood red under her wimple. You will give this message to your husband, won't you? He asked. She gave a small nod. Then Simon went on. If Erland doesn't come to my funeral, you must seek him out, Kristen, and tell him
this. Kristen sat mutely, her face dark
red. You wouldn't refuse to do what I ask of you? Now that I'm about to die, would you? Asked Simon Andersen.
No,
she whispered.
I will do it.
It's not good for your sons, Kristen, that there is enmity between their father and mother. Simon continued. I wonder whether you've noticed how much it torments them. It's hard for those lively boys, knowing that their parents are the subject of gossip in the countryside.
Kristen replied in a harsh, low voice. Erland left our sons, not I. First, my sons lost their foothold in the regions where they were born into noble lineage and property. If they now have to bear having gossip spread about them here in the valley, which is my home, I am not to blame.
Simon lay in silence for a moment. Then he said, I haven't forgotten that, Kristen. There is much you have a right to complain about. Erland has managed poorly for his children. But you must remember, if that plan of his had been carried out, his sons would now be well provided for, and he himself would be among the most powerful knights in the realm. The man who fails in such a venture is called a traitor to his king. But if he succeeds, people speak quite differently. Half of Norway thought, as Erland did back then, that we were poorly served by sharing a king with the Swedes, and that the son of Knut Porsche was probably made of stronger stuff than that coddled boy, if we could have won over Prince Haakon in his tender years. Many men stood behind Erland at the time, and tugged on the rope along with him. My own brothers did so, and many others who are now called good knights and men with coats of arms. Erland alone had to fall. And back then, Kristen, your husband showed that he was a splendid and courageous man, even though he may have acted otherwise, both before and since.
Kristen sat in silence, trembling.
I think, Kristen, that if this is the reason you've said bitter words to your husband, then you must take them back. You should be able to do it, Kristen. Once you held firmly enough to Erland, you refused to listen to a word of truth about his behavior toward you when he acted in a way I never thought an honorable man would act, much less a high-born gentleman and a chivalrous retainer of the king. Do you remember when I found the two of you in Oslo? You could forgive Erland for that, both at the time and later on.
Kristen replied quietly, I had cast my lot with his by then. What would have become of me afterward if I had parted my life from Erland's?
Look at me, Kristen, said Simon Dara, and answer me truthfully. If I had held your father to his promise and chosen to take you as you were, if I had told you that I would never remind you of your shame, but I would not release you, what would you have done then?
I don't know.
Simon laughed harshly.
If I had forced you to celebrate a wedding with me, you would never have taken me willingly into your arms, Kristen, my fair one.
Now her face turned white. She sat with her eyes lowered and did not reply.
He laughed again. I don't think you would have embraced me tenderly when I climbed into your bridal bed.
I think I would have taken my knife to bed with me,
she whispered in a stifled voice.
I see, you know the ballad about Knut of Borg, said Simon with a bitter smile. I haven't heard that such a thing ever happened, but God only knows whether you might have done it.
Sometime later he went on, It's also unheard of among Christian people for married folks to part ways of their own free will, as you two have done, without lawful cause and the consent of the bishop. Aren't you ashamed? You trampled on everyone, defied everyone in order to be together. When Erland was in mortal danger, you thought of nothing but how to save him, and he thought much more about you than about his seven sons or his reputation and property. But whenever you can have each other in peace and security, you're no longer capable of maintaining calm and decency. Discord and discontent reigned between you at Husaby too. I saw it myself, Kristen. I tell you, for the sake of your sons, that you must seek reconciliation with your husband. If you are even the slightest bit at fault, then surely it's easier for you to offer Erland your hand, he said in a somewhat gentler tone. It's easier for you than for Erland Nikolausen, sitting up there at Haugen in poverty, he repeated,
It's not easy for me, she whispered. I think I've shown that I can do something for my children. I've struggled and struggled.